So as I said, I want to discuss in these two shiurim tonight and next week in Yitz Hashem the issue of travel on Shabbat. There are two forms of travel that we want to discuss. One is going to be intercity travel, and for that I will discuss tonight the various interesting changes in practice that took place between the time of the Mishnah and the time of, say, the Maharik in the 15th century. And then next week I will go on to more modern problems, like traveling on the railroad, traveling on the tram, using the elevator. So those are the issues that I want to discuss. So the big obstruction to travel, of course, are the laws of Tchum Shabbat. Let's begin by reading what the Rambam has to say in Hilchot Shabbat. If someone goes outside the boundary of the city on Shabbat, he receives malkot. So he's not liable for karet or skila. This is not a malacha on Shabbat for which he would normally be liable for the death penalty. What he gets are stripes. Makom, zehu tchum ha'ir. The phrase makom, ha'yetzei ishmim komo, means the boundary of the city. Lo natna Torah shi'ur l'tchum zeh. The Torah did not give us a measure of how we construct the boundary of the city. Aval chachamim ha'etiku, but the tradition of the Chazal was shetchum zeh hu chutz l'shnei nasa mil. 2, 12 mil outside of the city, maybe roughly 8 miles outside of the city. K'neged Machane Yisrael. V'kach amar lahem Moshe Rabbeinu. This is what Moshe Rabbeinu said to them. Lo teitzu'u chutz l'machane. Do not leave the encampment. And leaving the encampment means within 12 mil. U'midivrei sofrim, but as a rabbinical enactment, shelo yetzei adam chutz l'ir eda al alpayim ama. That a person should not go out of town more than 2,000 cubits. Aval chutz l'alpayim ama, if he goes beyond the 2,000 ama, asur, it's prohibited. Sh'alpayim ama hu migvash she'ir. Anything that this limit of 2,000 ama are the backyards of the city. Nimseit lameid, so therefore you learn. Shemutav Adam b'Shabbat lahaloch et kol ha'ir kula. A man is allowed to walk on Shabbat throughout the entire city, afilu hayta kenimbe, even if it was a large city like London. Bein shahayta mukeket choma, bein shelo hayta mukeket choma, whether or not it had a wall or not. V'chein mutav lo lahaloch chutz la'ir alpayim amar lachol ruach mehubat ketavla mehubat. He's allowed to go out of town a square whose distance from the town is 2,000 amma. But he can choose the orientation of the square as he likes, so therefore he benefits from the diagonal if he's going in that direction. Right? So that he actually benefits from this form of drawing his grid of a square tablet around the town with the corners.
Can he draw it any way he likes to?
Yeah, so
he wants to go.
That's
why I go here, I can draw it.
Right. But in Yotza Chutla Alpayim Amah, but if he goes beyond 2000 Amah, Makinoto Makat Mardut, he's punished because he violated the Yisur Rabbanan. Ad Shnei Masar Mil, until he goes 12 mil. Aval in Yotza Ve'yirchik Min Ha'ir Yeter Al Shnei Masar Mil Afilo Amah Achat Loke Min
HaTorah. What were you doing when you directed Amiel when he was around 10 years old in the desert in Sinai on Shabbat, and we were camping out?
Because I wanted to establish that we could walk in that direction by declaring that our residence was over there rather than where we were sitting. So therefore we measured the Alpayim Amah from that place.
I see. Okay. Here was this child who was in the middle of the desert walking right. the path of Moscow, and suddenly followed by a camel.
Wait, the mats are unfortunate. Okay. All right. So now let's go back to the pasuk in the Torah, which the Rambam mentions. Shvu ish tachtav adyetzei ish min komo v'yom hashvi'i. Of course, that is talking about Moshe Rabbeinu's command that you should not collect the mon on Shabbat. It has nothing to do really with Chum Shabbat. It just simply says, stay put in your house. Do not go out to collect the mon on Shabbat. Rashi writes, Shvu ish tachtav. Mikam samchu hachamim arba amad liyosei chutz l'tfo. Shalosh l'gubo v'yachat l'fishut yadayim peraglayim. Ad yisei ish mimkamo elu alpayim amash al tchum Shabbat. Alo b'mfavash, but that's not the true explanation of this pasuk. She'ein tchumin ela midivrei sofri. Because the entire category of tchum Shabbat is only a rabbinical injunction. It's not a din d'oraita at all. So Rashi disagrees with the Rambam. The Rambam is of the opinion that Tchum Shabbat, at least 12 mil, is a din d'oraita, and Rashi is of the opinion that the whole concept of Tchum Shabbat is only an Isur d'Rabbanan.
Where does the 12 mil come from? There's some indication.
That was the Rambam said. It's because of the size of Machane Yisrael.
But this is indicated in the previous sources, or
yeah,
the first source.
The ikra shel mikra, but the real meaning of the passage in the Torah, alokseh haman ema. So Rashi states the position contrary to the Rambam, and this is a debate going from the time of the Tanoim all the way down to the time of the Rishonim as to whether the laws of Tchumim are dinim d'oraita or dinim d'rabbana. Okay, so let's take a quick look at the excerpt from the Gemara in Erevin, which derives the laws of Tumim. For a change, I'll read it in English rather than Hebrew. Where in scripture are these 2,000 cubits described? It was taught, Abayi, every man in his place refers to the 4 cubits. Let no man go out of his place refers to the 2,000 cubits. Whence do we derive this? Or because the reply reduce place from place, place from flight, flight from flight, flight from border, border from border, border from without, and without from without, since it is written, and you shall measure without the city for the east side 2,000 cubits, etc. So, by a word play, which is rather complicated, they derive the Alpayim Amram from. Okay, but why should we not deduce it from the verse in the wall of the city out with 1,000 cubits? The expression without is deduced from without, but not from outward. What material difference, however, is between the two expressions? The Gemara, the Shmuel, the Yishmael, in fact, teach the priest shall return and the priest shall come. Returning and coming mean the same thing. Such as comparison is made only when no like expression is available. There are one, but when one exactly like it is available, deduction is made only from the one which is exactly like it. So, this is a rather complicated derivation, and you can understand why many, if not most of the Rishonim, claim that the laws of Tchum Shabbat are only in Isur D'Rabbanan. Okay. Next, let's read another Mishnah, which is very important for us. And this is a Mishnah in Beitza. Kol shechayavim alav nishom shvut, nishom reshut, Mishum mitzvah b'shabbat hayavim alav yom tov. Every act that is culpable on a Sabbath as a shavuot, or as an optional act, or as a religious act, is also culpable on a festival. In other words, there's no difference between the laws of Shabbat and the laws of Yom Tov are concerned as far as these various prohibitions midrabbanan are concerned. Lo olin de'ilan, one cannot climb up on a tree on Shabbat or on Yom Tov. You're not allowed to ride on an animal on Shabbat or on Yom Tov. We're not allowed to swim on Shabbat or on Yom Tov. Below metapchim, and one cannot clap the hands. Below masapkin, and one cannot clap the thighs. Below marakdin, you can't dance. So on Simchat Torah, you're certainly not allowed to dance or to clap your hands.
Yeah, well, so if other people disregard it.
Right. The Tosfos discusses this. Okay. The Elul Heng Mishun Rishut. Here are things which have some activity which is has some significance, but nevertheless is prohibited. Lo danin, one cannot sit in judgment. Velo mekachin, you cannot betroth a wife. Velo cholzin, you can't perform chalitzah. Velo miyabnin, you can't perform yibum. Ve'elu mishum mitzvah, and these are the things which are permissible. Lo makdishim, you can't set something aside for the temple. Velo ma'avivin, ma'avichin, you can't estimate something's value for the temple. Velo ma'charimim, and you can't make a vow. Velo makdishim tu ma'omaser. Kol elu b'yom tov amu, all of these things were said in regard to yom tov. Kal v'chomer b'shabbat. So certainly all of these things are prohibited on Shabbat. Ein bein yom tov v'shabbat ela ochel nefesh b'lad. The only difference between the laws of Shabbat and the laws of yom tov are the issues of preparing food. Okay. So all of these are called shvut or reshut. And let's examine the shvut, and I'll quote a little bit from the Gemara. Lo olin be'ilan, you're not allowed to climb up on a tree. Yizeirah, shema yitlosh. If you climb up on the tree, you might pick the apple. And that would be a melacha. So since you are in danger of performing a melacha, of picking the apple on the tree, you're not allowed to climb up the tree.
You cannot climb a non-fruit tree either.
Right. Okay. Now, what's a principal concern for us? Below Rok Vin al Gabe Behema, you showed Dr. Schwab where we're at. Below Rok Vin al Gabe Behema, one is not allowed to ride on an animal, Zerah Shema Yitzei Chutzlutkum. Because if you're going to ride on this animal, you might accidentally go outside of the Tchum Shabbat. That would imply that the laws of Tchum are the Nimdioraita of the biblical prohibition, because otherwise there's a principle of angels ring zera with zera. You don't make one prohibition to enforce a second rabbinical prohibition. Ela gzeva shema yachtok smora. But therefore the reason is that you might pull off a switch from a tree in order to hit the to strike the animal. Okay? Velo shatin al pnei hamayim, zera shema yatzach avit shel shayatin. You're not allowed to swim because you might make a barrel to swim on. Okay. So the problem here, of course, is that this is, first of all, just reading the Gemara, we see that the Gemara doesn't really know what this prohibition against riding on a horse on Shabbat is, because it's offering two very, very diverse explanations. Secondly, we see that the Gemara here is of the opinion that the laws of Tchum are not a biblical injunction, are not a din d'oraita, rather a din d'rabbanan. And thirdly, the final explanation as to why you're not allowed to ride a horse seems rather far-fetched. You're not allowed to ride a horse because the horse may get a little disagreeable and you'll pull a branch off the tree and use it as a switch to hit the horse. A little bit of a far-fetched explanation. So we have to sort of understand what is going on here. Why was there a discussion? When we simply read the Mishnah and read the Gemara, one gets the impression that there was a well-known prohibition. You're not allowed to ride a horse on Shabbat. But the reason for this prohibition didn't seem to be known. And what we have to ask ourselves is this distinction between rabbinical prohibition and biblical prohibition, how far back did that go? In other words, in an important paper that the late Professor Gilat wrote about, I guess, 25 years ago, he makes the point that if you look at the list of the so-called avot melacha, the principal acts which are prohibited on Shabbat, and there's just a whole list of 39 avot melacha which are prohibited on Shabbat, the placing of that list seems to be completely out of place. In other words, if you were a modern author and were wanting to write the Mishnah about the laws of Shabbat, the very first thing you would do would be write down what is prohibited, that is, what are the various categories of melacha. Second, and this Mishnah which lists the 39 categories of melacha, is the second Mishnah in the seventh parak. So instead of it being at the very front of the Masechta, where its logical place would be, is buried somewhere in the seventh parak. Secondly, if you look at the first and the third Mishnah in that parak, you will find that the first Mishnah starts Klal Gadol Amur B'Shabbat. There's a general principle on Shabbat that if someone violates the Shabbat from various different types of work, which are all similar, he's only liable for one korban if he does this in error. And the third Mishnah on Shabbat says, Ba'od Yesh Klal Acher. Now if you have a Mishnah that says there is a principle, the main principle, and then there's a secondary principle, you don't stick in the most important Mishnah in between the first principle and the second principle. So Professor Gilat's reasoning is that the addition, the listing of the 39 Avot Melacha on Shabbat was late. That is, that whole list got into the Mishnah after the Mishnah itself had had its original redaction.
And when would that be?
That would be around the 1st to 2nd century of our era, the time of the Tanaim. So what Professor Gilat claims, and it's mostly plausible, and of course he got into a lot of trouble for claiming this, is that originally this listing of the 39 Avot Melacha was some sort of a footnote or a gloss for someone who had a text of the Mishnah, and that was then added into the body of the text. But at the time of the Second Temple, there was no such list of 39 Melachot. In other words, the whole notion that we take for granted today, that there are avot melacha and toladot, that is the principal prohibited acts and then minor prohibited acts, came when the study of the laws became more abstract at the time after the destruction of the temple. But in the earlier periods, there were a whole lot of laws which everybody understood, things which were prohibited on Shabbat, passed on from father to son, but did not fall under this scheme of the 39 melachot, 39 avot melacha. So Professor Gilat's claim is that originally many things that we take for granted today as rabbinical prohibitions were in fact traditional things which were prohibited on Shabbat. So people knew that you're not allowed to ride on a horse on Shabbat. But then once the listing in the 39 categories claimed, the prohibition against riding on a horse did not fit into it. And therefore, the Gemara had to look for some explanation as to why there is such a prohibition. Secondly, the notion that certain things carry a capital offense, and other things were just yud malkot, was not present in the Second Temple period. But when the laws of Shabbat became formulated and made more abstract, then they had to sort of lower the culpability for doing something like riding a horse and make it into either an isur drabanan, that is a rabbinical prohibition for some strange reason, like maybe you're going to pull a switch off a tree to strike your horse, or reduce it to an isur lav, like the Rambam says that going chutz l'chol. So the basic way that we understand this Mishnah in Beitza is that there were these ancient traditions of prohibitions of acts on Shabbat. There was no listing of 39 categories, but with the increasing influence of abstract thought and categorization that came into place with the writing of the Mishnah, when somebody had some list of what the actual Avot Melacha should be, taken from daily life or something like that, it got stuck into the Mishnah, and then the Gemara was puzzled by various other traditional prohibitions which didn't fit into this category. Something bothering you, Dr. Schwaber? Yeah, so that's Professor Gilad's. I copied some passages from Professor Gilad's article, but I'll let you read them. I think I've explained what he said. If you look in his collective works, his article is much, much toned down from the original article that he published in the American Academy for Jewish Research. But I quoted from the original. Alright. Now let's turn to one further quotation from the Gemara. And this is a braita on Masechet Shabbat on page 19a. Tanu Rabbanan. Ein machligin b'sfina pachot mishaloshet yamim kodem Shabbat. So you can't get on a ship to travel after Wednesday. If you want to travel by ship and you know that you're going to be on board from Shabbat, you should get on the ship either Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday. Okay? Ein mafligin b'sfina pachot mishlosha yamim kodem Shabbat. Bamed dvarim amurim lidvar reshut. This rule that you're not allowed to get onto a ship and leave port 3 days before Shabbat is if you're going for a voluntary purpose. Aval lidvar mitzvah, but if you're going to travel for the purpose of a mitzvah, shap yodam, it's permissible. Uposeki mo al menat
l'shvor.
That would be a
mitzvah.
Huh? The issue of what constitutes a bar mitzvah is obviously something which needs to be more carefully defined, and when we get to the 12th century, we will see that Rabbi Natan had a very broad definition of a bar mitzvah. But presumably this means that you're going to perform some necessary mitzvah. You're traveling to perform a brit milah, a relative, or something like that. Okay. Avol lidvar mitzvah shap yodam. However, if you're traveling for the purposes of a mitzvah, it's permissible. Uposekimo amanat lishbot, and you contract with the captain that the ship should pull into port on Shabbat. But the captain will disregard what you told him, and you're allowed to keep going. Give it to me. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer eno sabbat.
It is a non-Jewish captain.
A non-Jewish captain. You try to arrange that he'll pull into some port on Shabbat, so you won't be traveling on Shabbat. But you know in advance that he's really not going to pay attention to you. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, you don't need to go through the trouble. So the Braita clearly says that on the first 3 days of the week, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, you're allowed to get on board the ship and go. And whether this issue of performing this sleight of hand of telling the captain to stop and when you know in advance is not going to stop, whether it applies to the first 3 days or to the last 3 days of the week is not absolutely clear, but in any event, what we see from this braita is that Jews were allowed to go on board ship Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, and even though they knew that they would be traveling on Shabbat.
Did they go on long ocean voyages at that time, or did they not take new coastal voyages?
We'll see. Okay. Now, despite the fact that the that the Mishnah, that Braita tells us that one is allowed to go travel by ship on Shabbat, we will find that in the post-Talmudic period, at least during the periods of the Gaonim, the Jewish behavior became more strict. Okay. I'm going to now do a lot of quoting from Professor Katz's great book, because he deals with this in great detail, and I will deviate from his book a little bit from time to time. But basically, with the advent of OCR, I can actually simply steal passages in their entirety from the book without even having to retype them. So, okay. So, this is what Professor Katz says in his book, Goyishel Shabbat. The straightforward interpretation of Talmudic injunctions were not always in harmony with what occurred in practice. The accepted custom was something more lenient and other times stricter. The reason for deviation occupied halakhic authorities, and it is the most significant starting point for historical study. The question of setting out by ship demonstrates this amply. The aforementioned Braita asserts the prohibition on setting sail in about 3 days before Shabbat. It means that a person who embarked on a Shabbat 3 days before the Sabbath, that is more than 3 days before the Sabbath, is permitted to remain on board during the Sabbath without any question. So that's what we see from the Gemara. However, consider the following question to Rav Haigon and his response. So now I'm going to quote from a tshuva of Rav Haigon. Rav Haig. Hada Amor Rabbanan, Ein Machligin, etc. This quotation from the Braita that we just quoted. Mahu Linhod Minhag Zeh Benharo Kudolot Kumotit, Digelet Upat. Can we follow this law for travel on great rivers like the Tigris or the Euphrates? The Nilus Shel Mitzrayim, or the Nile. The Likanes Adam Besfina Shloshay Yamim Kodim LeShabbat. That a man can get aboard ship 3 days before Shabbat, the leishev bav Shabbat kishim alechet, and he can continue to travel on Shabbat while the ship is going. O eino gomnes finat hayam l'sfinat hanahar. Or is there a difference between sea travel and travel on a river? L'fish biyam mitrachet min hayavasha, eino yachol lotzeh minena kol zman shiyotzeh, because in the sea travel, they're far away from land, and there's no possibility of his getting off the ship when he wants to. Whereas if you're traveling along the Euphrates or the Nile, it's close enough to land that if you insist to disembark, you should be able to do so. Or is there another reason going on here that I, the questioner, don't understand? The Jews who were living in Egypt and its suburbs, they were very strict about not traveling on Shabbat on their Nile, and therefore they were careful to get off the ship on Friday. Until somebody came and told them that it was okay to travel on Shabbat. But still, some of the more observant Jews of Egypt still do not allow themselves to travel by boat on Shabbat. What should we do? Okay, and now here is Rav Haigon's response. Anu lo shamanu me'avoteinu v'lo mechachmei shtei yeshivot me'olam. We never heard from our forefathers or from either of the two great yeshivot. Mi she'etir l'shei b'sfinot ha'na'arot lo b'degelet v'lo b'pwat v'lo b'zulotah. We never heard anybody who permitted to travel on the Tigris or the Euphrates or any other great river on Shabbat. And the practice in Babel was to prohibit travel on the Euphrates or on the Tigris. And whoever came to Egypt and said it was permissible to travel on the Nile on Shabbat, lo yafe asa. He did evil. Ki afilu hayu mutav, even if it were permissible, patach lehem lekama kilchalot. He opened the door to them to many different difficulties. Va'amrinan dvarim hamutarim ve'acherim lo'ogim bahem isu, i'ata v'sha'oi la'atiram mifnehem. Things which are permissible, but nevertheless the custom in a given location is to be strict about it, you're not allowed to tell them that it's permissible. The kol shekein dvarim shelo matzinu behem heter, and certainly not to allow things that we don't know of any reason to be permissive about. Kishatam ayem divrei chachamim kulam, and if you look at what the Chazal said, iatam otzein davar ze beyam labad. Your only permission is to travel on the sea. Haflagah hisha amu ein maflegin. That the phrase haflagah means to distance yourself from the shore. Umuflag uvenahalot. Kedar shu muflag beyam. And he's making a pun here. And there's a great difference between travel on the river and travel on the sea. Aval badai ilu lo nitkaven adam l'shahot et atzmo v'sfinah v'shabbat. A man got aboard one of these ships that was going down the river, and he intended to get off on Shabbat. V'dachko Shabbat v'makom g'dudei chayot, but getting off on Shabbat would put him in danger of being attacked by wild animals. Shim yalev yeshev v'midbar choshishim l'mitato, that if he would disembark on Shabbat, he would be in danger of his life. To go yesh rebach badavar. On a situation like this, one should be allowed to get off. The afalti came, nevertheless, rabuta la'almo achmeit itanei Yisrael, the great majority of us, we Jews in Babel, and our scholars, nizarim ma'od, afilu b'chiyotze bazeh. Even in a case where there's a danger to life, v'chakwa ui la'asot. So Rav Haggad is reporting that the permission to travel by ship on Shabbat, which was seen in the Gemara, does, according to Rav Haggad, not apply to river travel. Not on the Tigris, not on the Euphrates, and not on the Nile. And let's listen to what Professor Katz has to say to this. According to Rav Haggad, exception was made only if it was dangerous to get off the ship on Sabbath Eve, where there are herds of beasts to endanger life if one sojourns in the wilderness. But great rabbis and steadfast sages of Israel refrained even in such cases. This undoubtedly refers to an ancient local tradition, probably dating from the Talmudic period, and it seems to contradict the literary tradition that did not forbid one from remaining on board ship if the journey did not begin close to the Shabbat. In other words, the Gemara that we have does not make any explicit distinction between sea travel or river travel, and therefore the custom at the time of Rav Haggad was stricter than the time of Gemara. Haggad resolved the contradiction by claiming that the Braita, which grants permission under the stipulated condition, was referring to starting out on a sea journey, as indicated by its terminology, sailing is what is prohibited. That Hebrew haflagah specifically indicates the sea voyage is stated also by other commentators. These others, however, concluded, as we shall see, that the entire prohibition did not apply to rivers. Just the opposite conclusion, that it's completely permissible to travel on a riverboat on Shabbat, whereas Haggad argued otherwise in view of the prohibition current in his country that there was no permissible way to remain on board ship on rivers. Okay.
What about the issue of getting off the boat on Shabbat?
Well, if you get off, you can get off, and then if you get off in a town, you'd be as if you were living in that town. You'd have to walk of the entire town. If you got off somewhere in the middle of nowhere, you would only have arba amot. Okay. The historically valid conclusion seems to be that one would do best to abandon the attempt to uncover the original reason for this prohibition on the basis of halachic principles that crystallized it over the course of time. If in Babylonia and Egypt, setting sail on rivers was strictly forbidden, such that pious Jews adhered to the ban even during the end of danger, we may assume that such action was considered desecration of the Sabbath, although not necessarily according to any formal halachic definition. There is no way to be sure of the extent to which this prohibition actually limited the freedom of movement of the Jew. We learned from Maimonides that it compelled Jews to take the alternative of traveling by caravan along the banks of the rivers of Babylonia. In Egypt, the prohibition was breached already in the days of Hygon. This was the reason that the inquiry was sent to him from Egypt. Someone had arrived and granted them permission. If in Hygon's lifetime there were still some who honored the prohibition, by Maimonides' time the prevalent custom was undoubtedly one of permission. And you will see that very shortly. Okay. The other aspect of the prohibition, setting sail on the sea 3 days before the Sabbath, has been breached and perhaps even abrogated completely during the Gaonic period. Justification for the permission granted was provided in the name of Bar Jacob Gaon Bar Mordechai. He found the basis for this lenient ruling while elucidating in a surprising fashion the veraita from which the prohibition was derived. One may not set sail in a boat less than 3 days prior to the Sabbath, but if, for fulfilling the precept, it's in order, the text also adds, and one must stipulate with the captain, that is on condition that he will rest on the Sabbath, and then he does not rest. This is Rabbi's view. Rabbi Simon ben Gamliel says that it is unnecessary to do so. Okay. The simple interpretation of the latter part of the Braita is that according to Rabbi, even during the first 3 days of the week is when it's permitted to set sail, one must stipulate with the ship's captain that he will rest on the Sabbath. For Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel rules he need not. The Gaon claimed that both Rabbi and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel were referring to the last days of the week. According to Rabbi, it's permitted to set sail provided the stipulation is made, whereas Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's opinion is that he not even strike this agreement and that Jamie set sail without it. So he sort of twisted the language of the Braita a little bit, said to allow you to travel. Okay. Now let's pass to the 11th century, Hananel. It is certain that Rabbeinu Hananel upheld the lenient view. Contrary to Hygon's explanation that the Braita was dealing with sea voyages and not with river sailing, Rabbeinu Hananel restricts the prohibition to rivers. And this only when the boat barely touches the bottom, the water being less than 10 hand breadths thick, deep. This ruling being derived from the rule of Sabbath travel limitations. The boat takes its Jewish passenger beyond the Sabbath travel limit. According to the tractate Beirubin, however, the rule of boundary limitation does not apply over 10 hand breadths above the ground level. That is, if the boat moves 10 hand breadths above the ground level, the travel limitation rule is void a priori. If the prohibition to set sail depends upon that of travel limitations, it can only apply to such a boat barely touching the bottom. In other words, one moving just above the riverbed. This explanation could produce a permissive ruling even regarding great rivers. And later scholars who were interested in such a position did base their decision on such reasoning. They undoubtedly strove to justify permitting setting out on sea voyages, as we may deduce from the way he included his concise commentary. For this reason, it is customary to journey on the great sea. In other words, Rabbeinu Hananel has now decided that the laws against setting sail on ship on Shabbat have to do with the laws of Tchum, of not being allowed to travel more than 12 or mil or 2,000 cubits. But the law of Tchum doesn't apply above 10 hand breadths above the ground. So if the boat is more than 10 tvachim above the bottom of the water, above the ground underneath the water, the whole issue of the laws of Tchum don't apply, and therefore it is permissible. So according to Rabbi Hananel, more or less just the opposite of what Rabbi Gaon said, that it is the case that this entire ruling only applies to shallow rivers where a barge or something is moving in shallow water and you have a problem with Tchum Shabbat. But sea travel or travel in the middle of a great river where you're well above the ground underneath would be permissible under all circumstances.
You could leave on fire, you wouldn't have to.
Right. We may safely say that this explanation, though forced and utterly rejected by later commentators, was produced only to resolve the apparent contradiction between prevalent custom and explicit Talmudic halacha. In other words, in Rabbeinu Hananel's time, he was a member living in North Africa at the time, in Tunisia, and everybody was setting sail into the Mediterranean on Shabbat, so we have to explain.
Nobody knew about submarines.
Right. Now, what about the Al-Fasi? Rabbi Zikalfati suggested a new reason for the prohibition. Namely, setting sail shortly before the Sabbath would make Omik Shabbat impossible because of seasickness, which affects a person at the beginning of the sea voyage. Accordingly, the prohibition would apply specifically to journey on the Great Sea, and consequently, Rabbeinu Hananel's conclusion that for this reason it had been customary to travel by sea would be nullified. In other words, just the opposite. As Amiri says, according to this, setting out 3 days before the Sabbath for secular purposes is forbidden. The Meiri does add that a basis for granting permission can be found according to the following explanation. Or anyone accustomed to it, in other words, if you don't suffer from seasickness, or if you take what Dramamine, whatever pill you take to avoid seasickness, or perhaps in our day for everyone, since the sailors are expert at it, since the ships have improved so much at the time of the Meiri from the time of the Gemara, that you should not be getting seasick by traveling, referring to improved sailing conditions as compared with those in the Talmudic period. Okay. Now we get to the Rama. The integration of these two factors, the change in physical reality, and the independent interpretation of the ruling of scholars living outside Balad Omega, is especially illustrated in the problem of traveling by boat on the Sabbath. In contrast to Babylonia, where traveling by river was considered forbidden, Maimonides testifies that the scholars of Spain used to sail along the Guadalquivir River from there to Alexandria by sea without interrupting their journey on the Sabbath. He mentions six of the most renowned sages of the generation preceding himself, the most recent of whom being Rabbi Isaac Alfasi and his disciple Rabbi Isaac Migash. Maimonides' testimony that Alfasi himself acted permissively is well known. And according to Alfasi's understanding, Maimonides too explained the prohibition in his code and responsibility, made no particular effort to secure the prohibition in actual practice. On the contrary, in connection with traveling by river, he said in the Chirota Rambam number 310, that by virtue of necessity, it is required to permit certain things previously forbidden. Okay, I'm going to, in contrast to Professor Katz, I'm going to spend some time reading some excerpts from this long Tshuva of the Rambam, because it has a number of amusing and interesting applications. Okay. But his main halakhic claim, as far as Abraham was concerned, is that the laws of Tchum did not apply over water. That's his position. Even though he believes that Tchumim are deoraita, more than 12 mil, nevertheless it doesn't apply over water, even if the water is less than 10 tefachim deep. It just doesn't apply over water. But I now want to read from the Tshuva of the Rambam. So let's read this a little bit slowly, because there's a lot of funny stuff going on here. Uvachal omar. In general, I say, Ki kol ma'amar shiyumasei le'echad min ha'ga'onim zal. Any statement which is found in the name of the deceased ga'onim, ha'mufosanim ba'olah, who are famous decisors, v'lo nimtza'a lehem ra'ayah b'ura, but we don't find any clear proof for their statement, lo nidche otam, we should not reject it, them, and we shouldn't try to twist what they're saying. We should say, maybe he has some proof, but nevertheless, it's insufficient for us to actually follow what he says. We won't apply it. So if there's a statement from a previous great scholar that it's not clear what his arguments are, we don't need to follow it until we understand his reasoning.
Unlike the Gemara.
This principle was already explained in the Gemara. If you have something that I said before I died and after I died, you do not understand the reasoning. On the one hand, don't tear it up, but on the other hand, don't follow it. You need to understand the reasoning. Okay. V'yaduhu etzlam, it's well known to everybody, umufosam, shenahar asbilia, the Guadalquivir River, it's from the Arabic Wadi al-Kabir, that's a river that goes from the Atlantic Ocean up through Seville. Shenahar Asbilia, he calls it the Seville River, Beino Uven Hayam Hamaluach, Shmonim Malim, between Seville and the ocean is 80 miles. I'm assuming that Malim means miles, but it's approximately right. According to our current maps, it's about 55 or 60 miles. The Haim, okay. The Yavovo Hasfinot, ships come up the Guadalquivir River, but Toanim Oto Shemen, and get loaded up with oil, presumably olive oil. They go down the river to the salty sea. And this is a constant flow of traffic from Seville, loading up the ships with oil and taking them to Alexandria. The Israel ba'imba, and Jews travel on these ships. Chachamim v'talmidehem l'fnei kol hagonim she'eshem. So Jews traveled on these ships in the presence of the great Gaonim who were there. Umash ani zocher mehem, and amongst those who I remember, the Gaonim who approved or traveled on the boats, hem Rabbeinu Chanoch, Rabbi Chanoch, Rabbeinu Moshe Beno, and his son Rabbeinu Moshe, Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben Geit, Ritzgeit, Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben Baruch, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Baal HaHalachot, that's the Alfasi, the man, okay, Rabbeinu Yosef HaLevi Talmido, Zal. So I remember all of these great scholars, and these were generations preceding the Rambam, but he had the tradition that all of these great scholars were traveling by boat down the Guadalquivir River to the ocean to Alexandria. Umi'olam no nishma mehen bazeh isur. And we never have heard a word of anybody claiming that there was a prohibition from these Jews traveling down the Seville River, down the Guadalquivir River to the ocean, and from the Atlantic Ocean into the Mediterranean and to Alexandria. V'chein kol anshei Mitzrayim. And similarly, all the dwellers of Egypt used to travel along the Nile, parenthetically, but that method is not necessarily some proof for us. We said this to the Gaon living in Babel to explain their behavior. Because they have Gaonim who prohibit travel by river. And then we explained to him that we have our own Gaonim who allow this. Unless you're going to say that our great scholars, because they don't dwell in Babel, you shouldn't pay attention to what they say, because the place matters. If you're a Gaon living in Babel, then you have some authority. Otherwise not, Epshah, maybe. So that's the Rambam's declaration of independence of the European scholars as opposed to the Gaonim and Baka.
We've seen that before.
Right, but here he's really quite cynical. Well, sarcastic is the appropriate word. We should read that last sentence again. Ella and Elo Hagonim Shalanu Bishvil Shein Arzotam Babel Ein Ra'ui Lashkiach LeDivrehem L'Fisha Makom Goreim, because the place of origin is what matters, not the degree of scholarship. Maybe, he says.
Play by national league rules.
Right. Okay, let's go on to the second interesting quote from this famous Tshuva of the Rambam. V'zeh Nahar Asvilia. This Guadalquivir River, Eino Rachov Ma'od, it's not very wide. The whole Misha Holech Bo, Yeresh Nevin Barot Mishnei Tzadav. Anyone who travels along the river will see two deserts on both sides, Omi Tzad Echad, Kimona Har Mitzrayim, just like traveling along the Nile. Umulam Lo Ala Badat Echad Mehen Isur Zeh Vishvil Migut HaMayim. And not a single great scholar prohibited the traveling on this river because of the shallowness of the water. And I've now got to explain this act of permission. Even according to those who are of the opinion that you're not allowed to travel in such a river or in a shallow river. We are obligated to permit certain things which were previously forbidden because of necessity. And what we know of the attachment that people have to their money. And in regards to the behavior of people who do things according because of their concern about their money, Adam Bahul Al Mamono, a man is upset or concerned about his property, if you don't allow him to take the goods out of his house, he will actually go and put out the fire. So the rabbis allowed a person to carry a certain amount of goods out of his house to save them when there was a fire on Shabbat, because if you didn't let him do that, he would put out the fire. Actually, our Gemara says just the opposite. So he must have had either a different text in the Gemara, or the person who referred to Shabbat, the editor who put in this reference to Shabbat Kufi Zayin on the day, was a mistake. But in any event, the statement of the Rambam occurred, the statement that the Rambam quotes, at least in spirit, occurs in many, many different places. And in a situation where people are concerned about their property, it says in the Gemara, Kimlu Rabbanan, the rabbis understood that Ein Adam Ma'amid Atzmo Al Mamano, that a person is not going to prevent from action when he has to save his money. This is talking about a man who finds himself out of town with his money and he wants to give it to a non-Jew in order to save it because he can't leave it where it is, where the people will come and get it. If you don't allow him to entrust his goods to someone, to a non-Jew, who can then watch them for him over Shabbat, he will then carry it for Amod Shatavim. Ukvar mitparsem etzleinu, she'elu hanimnaim mehalichot b'dgelet u'b'fat, v'hem tzurichim lelechet b'yabasha, v'hem esaknim b'mamonam, the people, if you don't allow them to travel on the river, and therefore have to get off the boat and travel by land, and they put themselves and their money in danger. If you don't allow them to travel on boat, they'll get off the boat and travel by land on Shabbat, and they'll put themselves in danger. Therefore, you have to be permissible to them in all cases. And therefore you apply the most lenient positions that you can find in the Gemara. And therefore you should not prohibit their travel by river, even according to those who say that it's not permissible. And certainly not, because in this case where logic demands that this thing actually be permissible. So Rambam is establishing another general important principle. Sometimes you have to allow for the violation of a isur in order to accommodate people's needs. So that's the second important fact that the Rambam tells us here. Okay. A third fact is, here's another amusing passage, that Tzarech Leda. You should know, anyone who wants to understand the fundamental principles of jurisprudence, if there was an equal amount of danger to ship travel or to travel by caravan, Minhalistim v'kalut ha'chaspanot, either because of being attacked by robbers or for shipwreck, right? Yihye ha'yoter tov mitzad hadat shetiye halicha b'nahalot. It would be preferable, from the point of view of religion, to travel by sea, lo b'yavasha, and not by land. V'afilu heya efshar lalu limnoa b'nei adam lalechet b'yavasha, kol zman she'efshar lalechem b'yom, o b'nahar gadol ha'yezeh yoter tov. And if we could prevent travel by caravan and insist that everybody travel by boat, that would be better. Ki, the reason for this being, most of the travelers by ship are not Talmudic geniuses, and don't know the laws. Since most of the actual travelers are not Goanei Yisrael, they don't know all the ins and outs of the law. If they travel by land, they're liable to perform acts which are Chilul Shabbat, because they just simply don't know the law. And he gives a whole list, which I don't need to bother to quote. If they have to go to relieve themselves, then they have to carry water to wash themselves off more than 4 amot in the Shittar. And a whole sort of, he goes through a whole list of things which I won't quote, but his fundamental principle is that the average traveler is not a Talmudic genius. So therefore, if you have the ability to choose between travel by land and travel by sea, where there's very little damage that you can do from the point of view of the laws of Shabbat, it's better to travel by sea, even assuming that they were equal. Okay, so we have three important lessons to learn from this marvelous Shiva of the Rambam. It's really quite long. I've only excerpted a little bit. One is the declaration of independence of the European rabbis from the authorities in Babel. Secondly, is that sometimes we are, because of necessity, we must permit things that were previously prohibited. And thirdly, if you have to choose between sea travel and land travel, it's better to choose sea travel because most travelers are not Talmudic geniuses. Okay, let's go now to Germany. In Germany, we find that Natan ben Hamachiri on board ship during the Sabbath, together with his mentor, our teacher of the Light of Exile, en route from Mainz to Worms. So they were traveling along the Rhine River. We also traveled along the Rhine River. I don't remember if we did it on Shabbat or not, but no. At any event, from Mainz to Worms. Rabbi Eliezer ben Natan mentions a custom accepted in... Rabbi Eliezer ben Natan mentions a custom accepted in his hometown Mainz of boarding a boat on Sabbath Eve just before sundown to travel to Worms or Cologne. Not that far. Not that far, but the ship boat travel was not that fast. Remember, there were no steamships, so they were traveling down river by current. Okay. And Rabbi Samson of Sen lists the three rivers, the Danube, Rhine, and Elbe, on which one may embark as late as Friday with no fear of Sabbath violation. They are apparently unaware of the Babylonian tradition forbidding to travel by river, or if they knew the ruling, they simply ignored it. They even interpreted the limited permission allowing embarkation during the first 3 days of the week as referring to travel by sea only, as Rashi emphasizes. He has two interpretations for the term haflaga used in the Talmud. According to both, it refers to sea journey exclusively. But in contrast to Rav Haigong, who said that it was only permitted to travel by sea and not on the river, according to the German scholars and according to Rashi, the travel by river is completely permissible with no restrictions, and it's only traveling by sea which requires 3 days in advance. This limiting definition, however, cannot explain why the prohibition of setting sail 3 days before the Sabbath should apply to sea-led travel but not to rivers. Furthermore, the Meiri writes, the practice tradition contradicted the teaching regarding sea travel as well. As stated by Rav Nachman Meiri, the commentators are all confused in connection with this topic, especially since nobody has ever refrained from traveling by sea, even on Fridays, and they have not heard of anyone protesting this custom. So, Meiri clearly says that our current practice, just as we saw, that in Rapaigon's time the practice was much stricter than what is listed in the Gemara. According to the Mahiri, they were much more lenient. Indeed, we find no one attempting to restore this old prohibition, as sometimes occurred when later scholars discovered that custom had deviated from halachically obligatory rule. It seems that the reason for this is the practical difficulty involved, on the one hand, and the lack of obvious connection between the old prohibition itself and actual Sabbath observance on the other. Yes? Okay. Back to Germany. In contrast with the Sephardic halakhic authorities, as well as those of southern France, who often made their halakhic rulings without taking into account whether they complied with accepted practice or not, the Ashkenazic counterparts were always very sensitive to the question of the correlation between the halakha and accepted custom. This Ashkenazic trait can be illustrated with reference to the two points under consideration: traveling by river on the Sabbath and setting sail by sea just before the Sabbath or even on the Sabbath itself. The leniency on both accounts was enjoyed by Ashkenazic Jews, apparently from earliest days. So in Germany, the practice was to be lenient completely as far as these laws are concerned.
To border on Shabbat?
Even on Shabbat. Evidence of this custom being approved by halakhic authorities comes from the Leibniz tradition ascribed to the Nachman Mechiri and the Samuel ben Meir, quoting Rashi, that it is permissible to board a boat on the Sabbath, to travel past the Sabbath limits, and to carry an object while on board. In addition, it has been ruled that even if one did not board the ship on before sunset, he may still set sail on the Shabbat itself. The doubts to be resolved according to Rashi's ruling concern the secondary halakha questions: whether it was permissible to carry while on board ship, whether this permit depended for its validity on whether the passenger was already on board ship when the Sabbath began, and whether it was permitted to board the ship on the Sabbath itself. The fact that one was permitted to set sail just before the Sabbath, unlike the Raita's 3 days limitation, appeared unproblematic in their eyes. And now we'll come to the Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam. Permission was undoubtedly accepted not only for rivers but for sea travel as well. For Rabbi Samuel ben Meir's ruling, admittedly with no connection to Rashi's tradition, has reached us in its original world. He deals explicitly with the question of why the sages permitted sailing in a boat on the sea. The rulings of Rabbi Hananel and Rabbi Isaac Alfasi were apparently unknown to Rabbi Samuel. In contrast to their opinion, he assumed that sailing by both river and sea involved a violation of the Sabbath limits prohibition, but that one nevertheless should differentiate between a person walking by foot on dry land, which is extremely troublesome, whereas a person on board a moving ship seems to be stationary, and he may make the use of the ship like he makes use of his house. Moreover, once the ship has moved, it's as if he is unable to stop it, since it's in the hands of a captain who steers it. He's a Gentile, and it's his power to anchor the arriving track. So the Rashbam introduced a completely new principle, namely that the whole issue of tchum doesn't apply when you're sitting down. If you're on a ship, and the ship is, the laws of tchumim apply when you're walking or maybe riding a horse, or something that involves some kind of strenuous activity, you're not allowed to go more than 12 mil out of town or 2,000 amot out of town. But if you're sitting on the deck of the ship, taking a little bit of sun and letting the ship go down the Rhine, then you're not doing any work at all, the laws of tchum do not apply. So this is a vast, vast heter.
Wouldn't that be the same thing as getting on the trolley car and where you go?
We will discuss that in Yitzhak Hashem next week. Okay? But the Rashbam himself tells us something very startling, which we will get to in a moment. These phrases, says Professor Katz, express the feeling of the Jewish traveler that he is not physically violating any of the Sabbath regulations, which from Samuel assumed was why the rabbis were not so strict on with boats. If this permit appears to contradict the words of the Braita, which rules we do not set sail, etc., Rabbi Samuel neutralized the source by ascribing the Braita to Beit Shammai, who ruled strictly concerning other labors as well, saying that they had to be finished before the inception of the Shabbos. So according to the Rashbam, this whole Mishnah is inapplicable because it's the opinion of Beit Shammai, and we do not accept his opinion. The fact that we're dealing with a widely accepted custom for which the support of the original literature was belatedly sought is proved by virtue of Rabbeinu Tam's evident proposal of halakhic justification different from that suggested by his brother Rabbi Samuel. So the Rashbam says that this whole Mishnah is only according to Beit Shammai, but the law is not that way, so you're allowed to get on the ship anytime you like. And furthermore, the laws of Tum Shabbat do not apply when you're sitting down and minding your own business and a boat is moving rather than you. Okay. Well, Rabbeinu Tam has an even more drastic explanation for why boat travel on Shabbat is permissible, and that's because of Aviva's question. The Braita Rabbeinu Tam, the Braita forbidding setting sail less than 3 days before the Shabbat adds, in what cases is this valid when the goal of the voyage is optional? But when it's obligatory, when it's a mitzvah, it seems to be all right. Rabbeinu Tam's contribution was his definition of Devar HaRashut, something optional, as being like someone going for a walk. In other words, going on a cruise is not allowed to be done on Shabbat. Whereas a person traveling on business is considered something obligatory. If you're doing this because you have to make a living and you have to get from Mainz to Cologne because you have some business obligation right outside Shabbat, that is a Devar mitzvah. Because according to Talmudic tradition, it is obligatory for a person to make a living from one's craft, from some craft. Since it's a mitzvah to exercise a profession, and it's an aveva to accept charity rather than being going to work, traveling on ship is considered permissible if you're doing it for business. So the only thing that's prohibited is to take a cruise on Shabbat. But if you're going for even your own personal business, you're fulfilling a mitzvah and therefore it's permissible. In actual practice, therefore, the prohibition against setting sail just before the Sabbath was in effect abrogated, while the permission to do so was extended to including setting out on the Sabbath itself. Okay. Now, I want to get to Mr. Katz's question. With the destruction of the Roman Empire, the system of roads that the Romans constructed fell into a state of decay. So, in the Dark Ages, from the destruction of the Roman Empire, say in the 6th or the 7th century, until the 11th or the 12th century, whatever roads existed became virtually impassable. The only way you could travel was by horse or by foot, but you couldn't have a coach.
Or by boat, actually.
Or by boat, but the roads were impassable.
Okay.
With all the ruts, etc., the only means of intercity transportation other than boat were by horseback or on a crude wagon, which was mainly used for the transport of goods. But in the 12th century, some roads were repaired, and a new means of transportation, the coach, was introduced. The following is the reaction of the Rashbam to this innovation. And I really don't know why Professor Katz did not include this in his book, because it's really very relevant, but this is what the Rashbam writes. The old Ratzla Rashbam lahatil yikanes bekaron b'shabbat v'nachrim o lichol chutz l'tchom. Rashbam wanted to allow you to get onto a coach. You're going to take the stagecoach instead of the boat from Cologne back upstream to Mainz. And because of his reasoning that the laws of Tchum do not apply when you're sitting still and the ground is moving underneath you, therefore there should be no difference between a boat and a coach. And now we have this new means of transportation, the coach. The Rashbam wanted to allow you to travel by coach on Shabbat. Okay? For Chazal Bo, but he changed his mind, and he showed Shema Yitzgahu Bo Listin, because they may be attacked by highway robbers. Of course, being attacked by highway robbers would apply any day of the week, so presumably the Rashbam would not like you to travel by coach any day of the week. So in other words, theoretically, as far as the law of Shabbat is concerned, according to the Rashbam, since the laws of Tchum do not apply if you're sitting down and on a moving vehicle, it should apply equally as well to the coach. Or maybe you forgot the laws of Shabbat and you get off the coach sometime in the middle and then you're going to be stuck there because the Tchum will apply to you. For Omeri, the reason that that even to get on this coach Friday afternoon should be prohibited. The dafka b'spina shari yikanes be'erev Shabbat. Only on a ship did they allow you to get on the erev Shabbat. Aval hocha kevim le'efshar lo le'reid asur. Miu b'spina eino la'achmir afilu nizlamein lo yabashash yoko le'reid bodo tzul rabbanah. They disagreed and said that the allowing for travel on Shabbat only applies to a boat and not to a coach. Presumably it's because they had a tradition of everybody getting on a boat on Erev Shabbat and traveling by boat on Shabbat, and the coaches were something new and they didn't have any such tradition. But the Reef rephrases it in the form of a general difference between traveling by boat and traveling by coach. Va'od, secondarily, im behemaman hei bakaron, pshita da asur l'shtamesh v'balei chayim shema yachtok z'mua. But if the coach is being drawn by an animal, and this I don't understand at all, because I don't know what other means they have propelling the coach on the road, I'm assuming that they did not pull it by human manpower to
put a picture
off. For intercity travel? Unlikely. So I don't know what Im Behemoman is, but nevertheless, because an animal is pulling the coach, it should be prohibited, because of the same reason you might go out and cut a switch to hit the animals. Now this is doubly far-fetched, because after all, you're sitting inside the coach, and the driver, who's a non-Jew, is sitting in the front, and if anybody's going to cut a switch, it's not going to be you. So, and the Maharik already makes this point that this argument that the cutting a switch on Shabbat and therefore it should be prohibited doesn't make sense. So I don't understand the phrase if an animal is pulling the coach, and secondly I don't understand this business about the highway robbers, because if highway robbery is prevalent, you shouldn't get on a coach on Sunday either. In fact, the Maharik in the 15th century claims that this principle of the Rashbam, that if you're sitting down and the ground is moving underneath you, rather than you're walking or traveling on a horse, the laws of Tchum Shabbat don't apply. The Maharik believes that the majority of the Rishonim agree with the Rashbam on this point. So therefore, the prohibition against getting on a coach on Shabbat, according to the majority of the Rishonim, says the Maharik, is only because of animal transport. And that itself doesn't make too much sense, because it's not you who are going to climb down out of the carriage to cut a switch, unless, as we said at the very beginning of this shiur, this whole business of the issue of cutting a switch is not the true explanation for the prohibition against riding on a horse on Shabbat. So that leaves us with the conclusion that riding on a railroad train from city to city on Shabbat should be permissible.
You don't cut off a switch to hit the train.
You're not going to cut off the switch to hit the train. The train is being run by a non-Jew where the majority of the passengers are not Jewish. And law of Tchum Shabbat doesn't apply, according to the Rashbam. So, in order to resolve this issue, you first of all have to decide whether the Rashbam really represents the majority opinion. That's what the Maharik says, but not everyone agrees with him on this point. And secondly, whether you can find some other reason to prohibit traveling on a train on Shabbat. But if the laws of Tchum do apply, there's reason to say that they don't apply going to anyone, because if the wheels of the train are sufficiently high that you're sitting more than 10 tefachim above the ground, in any event, it doesn't apply. Then it should be permissible to get on the train from Frankfurt to Berlin and travel on Shabbat. And I will skip from the 15th century to the 19th century, when the railroad was introduced, and we'll see how the rabbis of the 19th century reacted to this. But of course, to get on the tram within the city, if you're not buying any ticket or not performing any other thing that's prohibited, should be allowed because there's no issue with tchum whatsoever. But in contrast to the Rambam's view that we have to be even permit things that were previously prohibited, our current attitude is one should prohibit things previously permissible, and we will see the changes that actually took place. Now, the first person that I know who wrote about riding on a train, on an intercity train on Shabbat, was the Chatam Sofer. And here I have a little bit of a conundrum that maybe you can help me resolve between now and next week. The Chatam Sofer died in 1839. As far as I can tell from Google, which is my only source, the first trains in Hungary did not come into existence until 1848. The first train in Austria, going from the first passenger train in Austria, as far as I can tell, I have not taken out a book on the history of railroad travel, in Austria was in 1838, and the
Chuba... 38?
1838.
Yeah. But he died in 1838.
Right, but the Chuba that we have from him is dated from 1837. So my guess is that he never actually saw a train.
When did they start in England? 1820?
Oh, the 1820s. The trains originated in England, but it took them... The issue was financing.
But he may have heard of them.
So he may have heard of them. Undoubtedly he heard of them because he's writing a chuba.
And wrestled with the concept of it.
And wrestled with the concept. But his conclusion, namely... as we will see next week, we'll read it in a little bit of detail, his conclusion that it is prohibited because there's extreme discomfort involved in train travel. Doesn't seem to me to be based on a personal experience. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that riding on a train, even in 1839 or even in 1838, it was less discomfort than riding on a coach pulled by a horse on the rather rickety roads that existed
on the other roads.
There were actually claims, though, that it's unhealthy for you to travel more than 20 miles an hour or whatever it was. So the medical establishment at the time was...
I don't know. What I really need to know, which is a little hard for me to find out simply from Google, is whether the Chatam Sofer ever saw a train. I don't believe that he did. So he was issuing this testimony basically on hearsay that he heard about trains in Germany or maybe even only in England. So I don't know. But as we will see from a tshuva of Rav Uziel and Yetzer Hashem next week, certainly if you have a ticket and there's no issue of buying a ticket or anything else, traveling on when the MTA, for example, used to be free when you were traveling out the bound on the Green Line, for example, certainly getting on the MTA and traveling from Coolidge Corner to Cleveland Circle is a lot more comfortable than walking. So the objection of Chatam Sofer should not apply to tram travel within a city. Within a city there's no issue of tchum, and this whole business of discomfort is certainly not relevant. It's more comfortable to ride on the MTA than walk the couple of miles. So Rav Uziel, for example, and Rav Toledano permit the use of the tram, public transportation, if there's no issue of buying a ticket or carrying or any of the other provisions of Shabbat involved.
So it's established that Chatam Sofer never traveled outside of Hungary?
I wouldn't say that, but I just don't know. I mean, he was an old man. He died a year or two after writing this tshuva.
I wonder if he was in England in the
18th. I don't think he was ever in England. He came from Germany originally. He always signs his tshuva as Moshe Sofer Frankfurt the Main.
So when were trains first in Germany?
I don't know. I was trying to find all of this out.
Sure.
In the Austrian Empire, as far as I can tell, the first passenger train was in 1838. In Germany, they may have been sooner. In England, which was the origin of the steam engine, it was in the 1820s. So my guess is that he never actually saw it. But even if he had seen it, it's unreasonable for me to believe that train travel involved more discomfort than coach travel did in the 12th century over rather poorly paved roads.
And this was the noise.
He doesn't say anything about the noise. He said, we'll read his Shuva Mirza Hashem next week, but basically what he says is that if you're on a boat, it's you're in your own palace. It's like you can keep Shabbat as if you're at home. He never travels by sea. The seasickness either. Okay. The problem, what my plan is for next shiur is to go through a sequence of shuvot. I think because of the restrictions on the time, I will again be one side. That is, the Chatam Sofer prohibits train travel, but for a rather strange reason, namely the discomfort that's involved. And I'm not sure he personally experienced this discomfort. And as I said, I don't believe that this discomfort, compared to the discomfort of coach travel in the 12th century. His cousin-in-law, Rav Ullmann, who was also one of the great Hungarian rabbis, seems to me, from the tshuva that I've been able to discern, allows train travel on Shabbat without any trouble about the Tchumim. The Tiferet Yisrael, in his Kalkelet HaShabbat, prohibits train travel because of a violation of the Tchum, but that would not apply to travel within the city. The fly in the ointment, the thing that I think is one of the really more disastrous tshuvot, and it's not even a tshuva, it's a commentary, is by Yitzhak Shmelkis, who brings the issue of electricity. He has some great taboo on the use of electricity on Shabbat and Yom Tov, and therefore he prohibits tram travel on Shabbat. But as I say, Rav Uziel and Rav Toledano both permit the use of the tram if there's no subsidiary violation. And of course, there's a long tshuva of Rav Toledano permitting the use of the elevator on Shabbat if it's being run by a non-Jewish elevator operator. The problems that come into play here are some weird taboo that seems to have developed against the use of any kind of electrical appliance on Shabbat, which, as I say, originates with this tshuva of the Beit Yitzchok, which I think is just simply completely wrong, together with the creation of the so-called Halachic Technology Institute, there's a guy named Halperin, who was the head of some, what's the name of that institute, whatever it is, who made some strange ruling, contrary to all previous reasonable opinions that I know, that it's okay that an ordinary elevator, even if you're not operating on it, is okay to ride up but prohibited to ride down. But he invented some device which allows you to, if you modify the electronics of the elevator according to the prescriptions of his institute, allow you to use of these elevators. And the Israeli Knesset passed a law saying that every building which is more than a certain number of stories high, if it has more than one elevator, it has to have a Shabbat elevator, of course, according to the ruling of this weird institute on Shabbat. And naturally, the Haredi rabbis have now gotten into the picture because they have their own engineer who say that it's prohibited to use the
the elevator Mashkiach.
Right. So it's an unfortunate series of developments, which I will try to stay on the positive side of, namely on those rulings which are permissive, but rather than get into the, we'll mention it, the latest disaster with Rabbi Yashiv and company prohibiting the use of the standard Shabbat elevator on Shabbat, which of course is extremely unpleasant to the elderly and the infirm who now can't get down from shul to shul on Shabbat or to the eating hall if they're living in an old age home and have to go down. So it's an unpleasant development, but typical of modern times, where the position is exactly the opposite of the one emphasized by the Rambam, where one should try to accommodate people's needs and even allow things which were previously prohibited. Now one prohibits things that were previously permitted to make more and more demands.
So presumably a shuttle bus within a city, if you didn't have to pay and was driven by a non-Jew, would be the same as the train.
It's a little bit different because they're in contrast to the to an electric tram, the actual fuel consumption might be a little bit more sensitive to the number of passengers that you're on a bus. I mean, certainly you would not be allowed to drive a car, get into a car which was being...
You're saying the additional weight or something?
I don't know. In principle, there's a, you know, I think that if the bus stops at every corner, for example, like the trains normally do, then there might not be any reason to prohibit. We will read a long Shiva of Rav Taludano. He tries to take into account all forms of travel. But unfortunately, for some reasons which escape me, the Ashkenazi community does not recognize anything that the great rabbis of the Sephardic tradition, like Rav Uziel and Rav Taludano,
write about. Certainly a bicycle.
According to whom?
Well, I can't think how it could be.
Logically, there should be nothing wrong with a bicycle, but you will find strict rabbis who will prohibit it.
We were in Aspen about 20 years ago for a summer festival. They have, it's a beautiful town in the mountains, and they have these mini buses that stop at set stops, and you don't have to pay anything to get on. There's a set route. So if you stand at a particular stop, several people get on, others get off. It's not stopping just for you, it's their set stop. And you don't have to pay anything.
Right.
So we use it, and well, that was okay on Shabbat, and then someone said it had to do with Mara Sion that we shouldn't have used it.
Well, I don't know what Mara Sion applies unless they thought that you were going to pay. If it's permissible, it's permissible. We will start in Yerush Hashem with the Chatam Sofer next week, and I think the setup will be a little bit different because I would like to read some of these tshuvot in their entirety rather than excerpts the way we've been doing them now. And as I say, the one troublesome tshuva is that of Yitzhak Shmelkis, who very early on seems to introduce this taboo against any form of electrical appliance.
Is fuel consumption an issue?
Hmm?
Fuel consumption, is that an issue?
Fuel consumption where?
Well, with regard to a bus or a train.
Yeah, I'm saying that fuel consumption might be an issue with regard to a bus. It won't be an issue so much according with regard to a train because your contribution to the weight is negligible. And certainly with the tram, where the thing is being run by electricity, the issue of the fuel consumption way back at the generators in the plant should be completely irrelevant.
There's some sort of dividing point between little fuel consumption and more fuel consumption?
No, there's no dividing point between little and more. The issue is whether you're making some kind of an impact. Electric appliances should not involve any problem whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And as we will see, the leading rabbis of the 19th century had no trouble with your getting on a train. Even though in principle maybe there would be an extra shovel of the coal into
right.
the...
Right. That was my question.
Yeah. Okay, we'll stop here.
Is the church at the door also the one that's captured every four?